3rd District Congressman Ron Kine was elected to the U.S. House in 1996 and won an 8th term last November. But for the first time in 5 years, he and his fellow Democrats are in the U.S. House minority. The national November Republican wave of election victories took care of that. Congressman Ron Kine, thanks for stopping at Wisconsin Eye. It's our first interview since the election.
Steve, my pleasure. Anytime. And hey, go Packers.
We're not shy
of flying the colors this week.
Is there a game Sunday or something?
Well, I heard a rumor of that, but
go
everyone's
Packers.
Keeping
Are you going? Because you asked Obama for his ticket.
I did. And I figured that was the only way I'd be able to go. On the House floor during the State of the Union, I had a chance to talk to the president and said, since it's obvious that you won't be using your Super Bowl ticket now, I was wondering if you could throw it my way. And he laughed and said the Packers played a great game. They deserve to go. He wished him well, and he was looking forward to being razzed when he came to Wisconsin the next day for his visit.
So you didn't get his ticket?
No,
you're not going? You're like us, going to sit around?
I'm going to be back home with the family and enjoying the game like most Wisconsinites and rooting for a victory.
Well, I know you're busy. I've got a few subjects driven by today's news. A second judge in Florida just declared the individual mandate of the U.S. health reform unconstitutional. Does that bode ill for something that you care deeply about?
Well, obviously this has to work its way through the federal court system. This is just the second judge out of 14 that's had a chance to review the individual responsibility or mandate as a part of health care reform. But I think it's important that we continue to move forward on health care reform because it is a system in desperate need of reform. We knew what the status quo would bring, and that is higher costs for everyone, more uninsured in Wisconsin and throughout the country, businesses large and small less able to compete globally because of rising health care costs, and our public budget deficits continuing to explode because health care is the largest and fastest growing area of spending. So there's a lot in reform beyond just this individual requirement to obtain insurance, which is important for our nation to move forward on, and hopefully we'll get back to focusing on that.
Now, there was a U.S. House vote to kill it outright. That failed. You voted against that effort to kill it. But can the GOP starve it, sir?
Well, you know, by voting to repeal, what you were in essence advocating was an increase of our national debt by $1.2 trillion, which is what the nonpartisan independent congressional budget office analyzing the bill said that we'd reduce the deficit by over the next 20 years, over $1 trillion. So for those speaking out of one side of their mouth saying it's all about fiscal responsibility and getting deficits under control, and then first opportunity they have, voting to increase the debt by $1.2 trillion, which repealing health care would do, I'm not quite sure what they're talking about, to tell you the truth. But let's face it, right now there's a lot of important things that have already gone into effect. Today, 39,000 children with pre-existing conditions in western Wisconsin are now able to go out and obtain health care coverage, whereas before they were denied. 16,000 small businesses in western Wisconsin are receiving tax credits for the health care that they're providing their employees, making it more affordable for them to do it. Seniors falling into the donut hole will get a 50% price discount this year already, and eventually that donut hole will be eliminated because of health care reform. And our health care providers here in Wisconsin, who have been noted for some of the best quality results in the entire world, have not been getting compensated for that value care. There are tools in health care reform now that will lead to a change in how we pay for health care in this country, which is the most important thing we can do to get our deficits under control and to make healthcare more affordable for businesses and families alike. We need time now to move forward on it, but with this in mind, Steve, with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, the discussion and the work on healthcare reform does not end. In fact, it's just beginning. And we have to have the ability to learn what is working and what isn't, and then make adjustments along the way, because this is going to be an ongoing process.
Okay, I've got a lot of subjects, and you don't have much time.
Yep.
The latest blow to our national psyche was, of course, the shooting in Tucson. You spoke to the congressman the day before she was injured, sir. What did you two talk about?
Yeah, you know, Gabby Giffords is a close personal friend of mine. We both are members of the New Democratic Coalition, and we were on the House floor for quite a while that Friday before the Saturday shooting, and I spoke to her about a variety of issues, and then at the end of our conversation, I asked her how things were going for her back home, because I knew she had a real tough re-election campaign, a tough year with the public forums that she was holding. And she told me that she'd learn more tomorrow morning because she was having one of these Congress on the Corner meetings. And then she got real quiet and serious and said that she hoped that nothing bad would happen during that time. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's when the shooting occurred, and it was such a shock and tragedy. And she's making great progress right now, and all of us are keeping her in our thoughts and prayers.
And it's really miraculous what she's able to do so far. But if there's any good that comes from it, I believe, it's a greater focus and seriousness on the issue of mental health in our nation and the need for early identification to get people the help that they need, and especially with our children. We are losing too many of our kids who could be identified much earlier on and therefore get the help that they need earlier on so we can avoid tragedies like this and these random acts of violence that occur every day in our country, most of it relating back to some form of mental illness that needs to be treated like physical illnesses are right now in our healthcare system.
Are you doing anything differently? I mean, congressmen have to listen to people. What about the last 2 years? Were you surprised at the anger out there, sir?
Listen, the passion ran deep on both sides. And when I had public forums, whether it was healthcare or listening sessions, I noticed a lot more anger, a lot more people who were angry coming to it and sometimes approaching the table that I was sitting in a more hostile manner in that. But the answer to your question is no, I'm not doing anything different because Tony and I, you know, we live in western Wisconsin. We were born and raised there. We're raising our family there. If people want to reach Ron Kind, they can do it in church, in school, in the store, on the main streets because that's where we are. It's where we live. And I think it is important that people have access to their representatives, an opportunity to grab you, whether it's in a formal listening session like what Gabby was having, like I have every year in all 19 counties that I represent, or more informally, whether it is in the store or at church or whatever. And it wouldn't be healthy for our democracy if we continue to erect walls around our public officials, making it more disconnected from the people that we're supposed to be representing.
You're on Ways and Means. The debt clock is ticking.
Yeah.
The debt ceiling is $14.3 trillion. We're at $13.9 trillion now. What's going to happen? How that's going to play out with the GOP in charge of the House, Congressman?
That is the multi-trillion dollar question, Steve, to be honest. And let's face it, after an election where a lot of the focus was on excessive government spending and rising debt levels and what we need to do to turn it around, two of the larger votes that came up after the election that a lot of Republican colleagues voted for was the extension of the Bush tax cuts for 2 years that will add over $1 trillion in deficit spending, and then repealing health care reform, which will add over $1 trillion over the next 20 years to the debt. That's a quick way to double our national debt in a very short period of time, and that's what they supported. So where they intend to go in order to bring deficits down, I don't know yet. But I know where I would go, because I come from the Willie Sutton School of Budgeting. You got to go where the money is. They asked them why he robbed banks, that's where the money was. In the federal budget, the largest and fastest growing area of spending is health care costs. That's why payment reform that I've been pushing, that our providers have been calling for here in Wisconsin, is so important. When one out of every three healthcare dollar is spent on tests and procedures that don't work, that's $800 billion a year we're spending without getting a good bang for the buck. That's the most important thing we have to do to get our deficits back in check and make it more affordable for all Americans. Defense spending, that should not be taken off the table, but unfortunately so many of my Republican colleagues are doing that. And we've got a Pentagon today and a defense secretary telling Congress, stop appropriating money for Cold War weapons systems that our military doesn't need anymore.
But Gates has opened the bidding for cuts in the Pentagon budget at $78 billion. But the Pentagon this year, as you're aware, if you add in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, $700 billion.
Yeah.
And the Pentagon alone, $550. How much of a cut can our military spending take?
I think substantial, and make a real difference as far as the deficit is concerned, because what also doesn't get a lot of attention, and should, in fact, we just passed legislation in the last session, is changing the way we acquire, purchase the weapons systems for the military. Today, those weapons programs are $300 billion over budget. So this blank check that defense contractors expect from the American taxpayer has got to end. We can't afford that, doing business that way anymore. So that's got to be a part of the conversation when it comes to deficit reduction. But my Republican colleagues are saying, no, we're taking that off. It's the second largest spending program outside of health care that we have. And I'm going to continue my leadership on farm bill reform. It does not make sense that we're spending tens of billions of dollars every year of taxpayer subsidies going to large agribusinesses that aren't helping our family farmers here in Wisconsin. It's distorting the market. It's leading to greater consolidation in production and agriculture and making it very difficult for new beginning farmers to enter the occupation. And we need that more now than ever. The average age of a farmer in Wisconsin is 58. So you know they can't continue the operations indefinitely. We're going to need a new generation to step in. But These ag subsidies are going to a few but very large producers, consolidating the production and making it hard for family farmers to survive. And I think that would be disastrous for our food security system that we need in the country, or our ability to help feed the world, which is going to need production agriculture coming from the breadbasket, places like Wisconsin.
The latest, a brand new projection says the social security system goes bankrupt in 2037. You're on that subcommittee on Ways and Means. How did you feel about the deficit commission option of raising the retirement age to phase it in from 65 to 69?
Well, right now it is being phased into 67, so it'd be from 67 to 69. You know, I don't have a problem making adjustments, age-appropriate adjustments, but there also has to be exceptions and exclusions for the longtime factory worker working the line. And expecting them to continue that up to 69 or 70 or wherever is just unrealistic. They're not going to be able to do that. Other professions will have an easier time doing that. So I think there has to be a distinction made in that regard. But I would also hope that other things should be considered. The indexing that's in place right now could be adjusted so that people aren't losing real benefits, but it doesn't grow as fast in the future to make it more sustainable. I think we should be means testing Social Security. I don't know why people like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or even Senator Cole, God bless his soul, should be expecting complete payment out of Social Security all the years in their retirement when they don't need it.
That ends at $106,000 right now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
About there?
Yeah, it's capped as far as their contribution into the system.
And you'd like to see that cap raised to?
Well, that's another area that perhaps we can explore, is raising that cap so that there's more contribution from the wealthier Americans that can afford more of it. But I do know this, Steve. Over 70% of the seniors living in my congressional district in western Wisconsin rely on Social Security as their primary source of retirement income. And the idea now of privatizing Social Security and putting that money into the stock market, subject to the volatility that we've seen in recent years, does not make sense. If there's one tool to the retirement security system we have in a country that should be immune outside from stock market fluctuations, it should be Social Security. But unfortunately, my colleague Paul Ryan, that's exactly what his plan calls for, privatizing Social Security and putting that money in a stock market that just 2 years ago lost over $17 trillion of wealth overnight. That would be disastrous. Or his idea to privatize Medicare by setting it up with a private voucher program, saying, here you go, seniors, here's $5,500, now go out and shop for your own health insurance. Well, either he ignores or he doesn't realize that the reason Medicare was created to begin with is a simple fact. Private health insurance companies do not want to insure seniors. They're not profitable. As we grow older, we consume more health care. That's why Medicare had to be created to begin with. So seniors had a place where they can go and obtain health care coverage in their later years. And the idea of privatizing that now sets us back to pre-1965, when the poverty levels with seniors was astronomical. They were the largest poverty group that we had in our country. Mm-hmm. That changed with Medicare.
Congressman Ryan is kind of the GOP flavor of the month. Are you jealous?
No, I like Paul. We've worked together on a variety of issues. I think it's healthy that there is a vibrant debate going on about the direction of our country and how we can get there. I think he and I share a lot of similar goals. There's got to be a reordering of our fiscal house as a nation in order to sustain the type of prosperity and growth that our children should expect. But we just have different ideas in certain areas. He and I have teamed up on farm bill reform, and we all likelihood will again this time because we are in agreement on it. But I do disagree with him on some key points. Privatizing Social Security and Medicare, I think, is the wrong approach to it. There are other things we can do to save money and maintain the solvency of those programs for many decades to come, rather than just dismantling them in their current form.
Okay, questions on the world. Are you more worried, which of the two areas of the world are you more worried about? The collapse of the Eurozone with debt, or Tunisia, Cairo, Yemen, Syria? Which of those two hotspots pose the greatest threat to America?
Well, there are hotspots. I would include North Korea in the mix, because you have such an unstable, unpredictable regime up there capable of making a mistake and igniting a regional conflict overnight. But there are some challenges. I'm less concerned about the Eurozone. What the EU is doing in response in order to stabilize their finances, what the countries are doing in response, will ultimately lead to greater stabilization and certainty in that market. But the Middle East is still a tinderbox, I fear. But it's also a very young population in that area. The Muslim world is some of the youngest people that exist on the planet. And they're up for grabs right now. And they can go one of two ways. Yeah. They can grow up hostile, hating the United States of America, or we can figure out a way of constructively engaging that part of the world too, for our benefit, but also for their benefit. And that's still a close call today.
Do you think the President Mubarak of Egypt has been there 30 years? Time, do you think, is there any choice but for him to leave?
Yeah, I think his days are numbered. It's only a matter of time before the military asserts itself and figures out, hopefully, some peaceful, orderly transition and a coalition government being formed, one which will hopefully lead to a peaceful transition to democratic elections being held in the most populated Muslim nation in that region, Egypt. And I think signals are being sent right now. It would have been nice to have administrations a little more forceful in the area of reform within Egypt, but for 30 years, Mubarak wasn't open to those suggestions. And now the street is bringing that upon him without his choice. So I think it's only a matter of time here, perhaps days or weeks before you see regime change take place. But nature abhors a vacuum, as does politics. Mm-hmm. And the real question is, what comes after Mubarak? And there again, I think it's very much up for grabs. If it's the Muslim Brotherhood, that would be very bad for our long-term interests in the region. We could have a government there that refuses to recognize the peace treaty with Israel that's been in existence since Begin Sadat. That would be a setback to Middle East peace talks. Or it could be one that leads to democratic elections being held in Egypt and a model of reform for the rest of the region.
Do you have confidence in President Obama's team to deal with these hot spots, North and South Korea, Eurozone, Egypt?
Well, I think they have a very solid foreign policy team, starting with Secretary Clinton. And listening to her over the weekend, it sounded like she was saying all the right things. She wasn't backing Mubarak, even though they've been a strong ally to the United States, an important ally for many years, but basically saying this is going to be something that the people in Egypt are going to have to resolve, and that what is needed is reform within Egypt. But sometimes these issues get thrust upon any sitting president in the administration. We expect them to rise to the occasion. But we also expect there to be some good bipartisan cooperation in dealing with U.S. interests offshore. Unfortunately, that's not always the case when it comes to our own domestic politics. Mm-hmm. But there's been an understanding that politics should end at water's edge, and that there are national interests that we need to promote overseas. And the time to be criticizing a president and administration is not when there's a foreign policy crisis, which could undermine their credibility when they need it the most.
We've seen President Obama's poll numbers go up and down. What does he have to do to be reelected next year, Congressman?
I think so much of it really does come back to the economy and jobs and making sure that we're still heading in the right direction. Now, granted, you know, I think we have made progress in the last couple of years here. We've had 11 consecutive months of private sector job growth. We've had close to $13 trillion of wealth restored to the stock market since its low when he took office. People tend to forget that the moment he said I do as president, we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. And since then, 11 consecutive months of private sector job growth. Where we're losing jobs today is in the public sector. Mm-hmm. And that's why the unemployment rate is stubbornly high. But we're starting to see a turn in that regard. Everyone just wishes it comes back quicker. Financial sector is stabilizing. Housing is still stuck, and it's what led us into the recession. We're going to figure out a way to get housing back on its feet and construction again. And there are, I think, smart spending decisions and dumb spending decisions that we have to make as we move forward. And I think the president was hitting the right notes the other night during his State of the Union. We have a choice to make, because it will be made for us if we don't, of whether we want to remain the most innovative, creative, and competitive nation in the world. That means we've got to make some smart investments in the STEM studies of science, technology, engineering, math. Those are the fields of growth where most of the jobs are going to be created in the decades ahead. Basic and applied research in both the public and private sector to move forward on. Modernization of our infrastructure system so that we have an infrastructure that can sustain economic growth and job creation mm-hmm. in our country. The build out a broadband connection to every inch of our territory so no one is left behind. But I am concerned about some of the decisions being made back home here, turning $900 million away in development of a high-speed rail system to help modernize our infrastructure as a state sends a bad signal, and our neighboring states are going to move forward. So it could lead to the economic isolationism for our state's economy. effectively shutting down the wind industry in our state, where we could have been bringing in manufacturing jobs for wind turbines and wind capacity, will basically say we're not open for business for renewable energy development. And also the whole biotech research that's happening right here in Madison that can lead to a lot of new industries and businesses being created, creating good-paying jobs at home. These are things that we've got to address as a state to get our own economy on track.
You're the most senior member of the U.S. House from Wisconsin and the second most in seniority from Wisconsin in Congress. Mm. Do you consider yourself the de facto leader of the Wisconsin Democratic Party?
Well, I just consider myself someone who's got to stand up for our state interests right now, work with my colleagues, and promote those interests. Because a lot of the fights that do occur in Washington aren't partisan or ideological. They're regional in nature. Competitive grants or funding formulas, making sure Wisconsin gets its fair share shake at the end of the day. We've got a transportation reauthorization bill coming up shortly. And working with Tim Petri and others, we've been successful in the past, making sure we at least get parity back to Wisconsin for every buck we're sending in. We're getting a buck back as a state. We're going to need to continue that against other powerful congressional delegations in other regions around the country. And that's an important priority that I have, standing up for Wisconsin.
Do you want your name on the list of potential Democrats to run for governor in 2012?
Listen, I have a lot on my plate right now, staying focused on the challenges that we obviously have in this session of Congress. With the economy that we have, getting it back on track, making sure health care is implemented the right way, not the wrong way. And also the fact, and unfortunately, in last year's election, it didn't receive much attention, but it should. We've got two wars going on still, Iraq,
Afghanistan.
And our fair share of Guard and Reserve and active duty personnel from Wisconsin who are being deployed, sometimes in multiple occasions, creating a tremendous strain on our military personnel and their families. And the economy that's affected too. So I would like to see a little more focus on where we're going in both Iraq and Afghanistan, because it was so important, not only for our relationship in those tough regions, but our military back home and the family, families that support it.
And I have to correct myself. The next election for governor is 2014.
Right.
I misspoke. I moved it up 2 years. My final question, if Herb Kohl decides to retire, would you run for the U.S. Senate?
Well, you know, you never say never to these. A lot of being in politics is being in the right place at the right time. But I can say I enjoy my job right now. It's a great honor to be able to represent your home area, the place where you were born and raised, in a place like Congress, especially now when the issues are so large and so challenging, from budget deficits to a health care system that's in need of reform to getting this economy on track, creating good-paying jobs. And if I had to prioritize, I'd say it's economy, jobs, number one, budget deficits, number two. Got to be focused on those two things because they're not mutually exclusive. We're not going to be able to outcompete China if we keep borrowing money from China because of the large deficits that we're running at home. So these things need to be worked on simultaneously.
Third District Congressman Ron Kind, thank you. Nice time.
My pleasure.
Nice time.
Go Packers. Come on. We can do it.
Thank you very much. Thanks.